I'm going to start with a short form of Psalm 124. No, were God not with us, rage would have swept us away in torrents of hate. No, were God not with us, rage would have swept us away in torrents of hate. Which just happened to turn up in my morning readings this week, which was quite apt. Last time I got up and spoke, wow, you're very wired today. I might have to do a bit of skittle action. Last time I got up to speak, I talked about there being two key ways that we encounter Scripture, not the only two, but two key ways we read our Bible, one of which is that we bring to it the issues that we have and we see what wisdom and resources we can gain out of this ancient tradition for what we're coming with. And the other that we pick it up as much as we can with a clearness to say, what was it trying to do in the first place? And maybe it's got nothing to say to me. And that's normally where I stand from when I speak up here, but today I'm going to come from the other direction, which makes me really anxious, to be honest. So I hope that's okay. It's not my normal way of speaking, but it feels like what I needed to do today. It feels like using the resources from lots of years of doing the other thing to, when something rises up in me that needs to have an answer, to dive back in. So, a month ago, Donald Trump managed to get himself elected the next president of the United States. And I don't want to make any assumptions about how anyone here feels about that. I know there is a lefty pinko leaning, but I'm going to share my response to that, and you may find things you connect with or not. My response is to be deeply, deeply troubled. I've had a physical response of revulsion in me. I'm well in the stages of shock and denial. I haven't even got as far as anger, which is the next stage of grief. I'm a professional historian, so I am professionally obliged to notice patterns that are very, very alarming from the past being echoed, and they make me want to hide. I cannot even say his name most of the time. I refer to that man. Now, this is not for me just about international events. I have a deep and confused love for America. I talk about that. 20 years ago, I lived in America for a year. I was young and foolish, and I went for a year to be part of a Christian music team. We travelled around, staying with youth groups, staying with churches, being billeted by American families. Mostly I was in suburban or commuter belt areas, mostly white, middle class, fairly conservative American Christians. I was 19 when I left, and I'd just done a semester at UWA studying two units, both one on the 20th century history of the United States and one on the 20th century history of Latin America, which did not leave me in a place inclined to love America. Now, none of this makes me an expert on America. My experience is 20 years out of date, and particularly it's pre-September 11, which was a big cultural change. But it gives me a heart for the place, and it gives me context on the inside. I asked for Precious Lord this morning because it's a song that one of the five Americans I travelled in a bus with for a year would stand up when we did concerts and sing that nearly every night of the year that I was there. And she, at 18, had a voice that could hold a room when she sang that. And the cry of, oh, I can't do this, I need someone with me, is where I'm feeling at the moment, but also it's sentimental for me of the people I lived with. Through the strange tool of Facebook, I've reconnected with a whole lot of those Americans. And in the last year, I've had a window into the election cycle. Mostly, it's probably no surprise, the people I've kept in touch with are more progressive, but I also have lots of Republican voters in my Facebook feed, including some who voted for Trump. I also have a beautiful woman, Kathy Pino, who I think is the only activist in her family, and she has been facilitating respectful conversations with her family and her friends who are on the other side from her, trying to say, help me understand, and I've been privileged to be able to spy on those conversations. Facebook's very strange. So on the 9th of November, I watched first the hope and then the despair of my friends roll across my screen. By the 10th, my lesbian friend in Nebraska was organising a passport for herself and her wife and their two sons so that when the persecution starts, she can flee. This was not theory. She was actually going to get a passport because the president-elect and his followers had said they were intending to criminalise her marriage, which was legal, and take her children from her. I think it was about after hearing her plans for making an escape from the country she loves that I found myself in the shower where I pray, asking God, what comes next? What do we do now? And I felt I heard, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. And I wept and I wept and I wept. I'm going to weep again, I'm sorry. Because that was not the answer I wanted to hear. And it was not the answer that I want to live into. Because it hurts too much. Love your enemies. This is from both Matthew and Luke. It's also nearly the same in Romans 12, which comes just before Romans 13, where Paul says, be obedient to the authorities. He first says, love your enemies. But today I'm particularly going to look at it in Luke. Luke 6, verse 27 is this verse. It's part of Luke's Sermon on the Plain, or Sermon Beside the Mountain, which is the equivalent of Matthew's Sermon on the Mount. It's about a third the length. It's the short film version. It starts with the Beatitudes, Luke's version of the Beatitudes, and Luke also includes woes. Blessed are you, and woe to you. The Beatitudes audience, both those who sat on the plane listening to Jesus and those in Luke's community who he edited that for, were almost certainly people who saw themselves in the categories that were called blessed. Poor, homeless, sorrowing, grieving. And they probably envied those who were described as woe to. They were possibly even being oppressed and attacked by the wealthy, the well-fed, those who were spoken well of. And they quite likely saw those people as enemies, which I think is why Luke then immediately follows up with love your enemies and pray. He's saying, those people you normally envy, I'm telling you, actually, they're to be pitied. Why woe to the rich? Why woe to the well-fed? Why woe to those who people speak well of? Well, maybe because they're so full up with irrelevant things that they haven't got any space for the things God actually yearns to give, like welcome and acceptance and forgiveness, compassion and community and hope. So those ones you envy, they are to be pitied. And those people you normally hate, I'm telling you, they are actually to be loved. Maybe because they're the same ones. Some interpreters claim that the idea of enemies here is intended in a family sense, that it's talking to a Christian community where families were preventing other family members from joining the Christian movement, and that the examples of turn the other cheek, it follows on with turn the other cheek, give your cloak, if someone takes your cloak, give them all your clothes, that this was strategies, response to strategies that probably parents were giving to their children to try and stop their children getting out of the house and going to these Jesus meetings and giving all their money away. And that the responses are, how can you be a member of this family and also continue to be loyal to Christ? Some interpreters take it another way and say the enemies here are enemies of the faith, particularly specifically those who are persecuting you because of your allegiance to Christ. And then this becomes an evangelistic text. Some people can do that with anything. The idea being, we're claiming to follow this Christ of mercy, so don't confuse the message by retaliating with hate. Don't attack. Let go of your own personal rights in view of the greater good of the program we're with, the Spread Jesus Message program. Now, that's normally interpreted to mean if you're being persecuted because you've got the Jesus badge on. But it can also be taken as if you're being persecuted because you are living in a Christ-like manner, if because you are upholding the poor, because you are being a disturbing presence calling out oppression, you are being persecuted for those things, let go of your own rights because those causes are more important than your personal rights. And some of those I hold with more weight than others, but both of those approaches put brackets around enemy to make it just a subset of enemies. But unfortunately, I think the text means love all your enemies. And the word is agape, the active love, the love of God, willing good for us. It's not love as sentiment, it's love as action. Luther saw this sermon, as in the Sermon on the Plain, or Matthew, particularly Matthew's Sermon on the Mount, which is more moralistic than Luke. He saw them as designed specifically to show us our need for grace by outlining how high the bar actually is, that is impossibly high, so that we would be shown, therefore, our need for God. And there is some truth in this. Maybe I say that just as someone from a Lutheran tradition, but we don't discover how high the bar is by reading the text and having a think about it. We discover how high the bar is by having a go. It is by trying to love our enemies that we discover our need for mercy. For Luther, this is kind of the end point. Actually, to be fair to Luther, probably for those who interpreted and followed Luther more than Luther himself, the end point is that we fall into the arms of God. I think it is an end that leads us back in. We fall into the arms of God, and it's the only place from which we have any chance of living in the direction that we're called. And we go on trying to live in that direction, knowing that we are loved, even as we fail to really pull it off. Why would we do this? I have to tell you, my children came and sat on my lap in my office yesterday and wanted to know what I was doing. So I said, this is the bit from the Bible that I'm going to be talking about. And I read, love your enemies. And they cacked themselves laughing. And I went on and read the next bit, pray for those who are mean to you. On the floor, rolling. I read, and then I got to the end and I looked at them and they said, read it again! And they did it twice. Because we hear it, we're familiar with it from Christian culture, and we've forgotten how absurd this is. They knew that this was crazy. This is not what we do. I asked them to rephrase it, and they told me, you love your friends, and you're mean to your enemies. They knew. So why would we do this? Martin Luther King, who has a very famous sermon on this text, it's probably no surprise, gives three reasons that we would do this, that we would love our enemies. And none of them is because Jesus said so, by the way. The first is to cut off the chain of hate, because hate intensifies hate. The more we hate, the more hate there is. Someone has to cut off the hating, and that's the call to us. The second reason is to save myself, because hate distorts the hater. And the third reason is because love has redemptive power. And love can bring change where hate cannot. This is not a guarantee that love will bring change. But love can bring change, and hate never brings change. And for King, this is not an impractical idea. This is an absolute necessity for our communal survival. Because our future is tied up with the future of our enemies. Walter Wink, who follows the ideas of Martin Luther King, probably many of you are familiar with Wink, he wrote some really key texts about 25 years ago about the hidden powers of systems and structures. And he says we love our enemies because God loves them. It's so simple to say that, isn't it? He says we love our enemies because we have more in common with them than we have different from them. Particularly, we have a common parent in God. And we have a common tendency to do unrighteous things. Wink has a chapter in his key text called The Gift of the Enemy, which he has because he says enemies are not so much hurdles we need to get past on our way. Enemies can, in fact, be our way to God. to say, I don't like any of this, and I'm absolutely rubbish at it. So just to be clear that I'm not up here telling you because I'm good at it or I like it. I've really wrestled with doing this today because I did not want to do this. I did not want to stand up here and preach on this because I know I'm no good at it and I don't like it. I don't like it at all, but I felt really strongly that this needed to be said. So I'm sorry. How do we do it? How do we love our enemies? Because it's all very well in principle, but how do we actually do that? I'm kind of conflating Martin Luther King and Walter Wink's work, but they both say we start with ourselves. King talks about deeply considering what the enemy hates or reacts to in me. And is there a kernel of truth in it? Have I, or my ancestors, or my type, done things that might be hate-worthy? Am I too afraid to ask that question? I am. I am too afraid to ask myself that question. I don't want to. Start with myself. Walter Wink talks about how we repress the things that we don't like in ourselves and we project them onto our enemies. He's particularly good at talking about the way if we have a notion that we must be perfect to obtain God's love, then we hide our imperfections deep inside because otherwise we don't have any access to God psychologically. And then when we find someone who mirrors back to us the things we are hiding from ourselves, he talks about us having a psychological necessity to hate. Because it is the only way we can protect ourselves from our hidden imperfections that we are hiding from, because otherwise we cannot access God's love, because we must be perfect to access God's love. You've heard me speak enough to know that I think it's absolutely false to say you must be perfect to access God's love. Walter Wink puts it, only when we hold ourselves as broken and beloved can we respond appropriately to our enemies. Because it's in our being broken and beloved that we do not need to fear the things inside ourselves and put them onto someone else. Only when we hold ourselves as broken and beloved. Because then we can respond to the often actually small list of what's genuinely wrong in the other. We're not stupid people. We have enemies, mostly because people do nasty things to us. But we can respond to what's genuinely wrong and not to the quite long list of things I don't want to notice in myself that I've projected onto someone else. So that's start with myself. And the second thing, find the kernel of good in your enemy. That's Martin Luther King's words. Or Walter Wink talks about, consider what lies behind the characteristics you can't stand in that enemy. And maybe a clue to that is to make a list of the things in the other that you don't like. And then think, which of those actually are in me? And what's behind that for me? I can't stand controlling people, bossy controlling people, of which I am one. What is underneath my need to control? Well, maybe I have a sense that things could get a lot worse, and if I can just manage it, then we can keep things at least moderately okay. And I've got a fear. There's a fear lies behind my need to control. So if I can find that in myself, then I can look at an enemy who is controlling and bossy and think, maybe they're afraid. Maybe they're sad. Maybe they feel that nobody wants them. And the third way, the third thing, look first to yourself, find the good in your enemies. And when you have the opportunity for revenge or retaliation, when you have the opportunity to win over, win, don't take it. says Martin Luther King again, because the ultimate goal is not for me to win and them to lose. The ultimate goal is to win them with love, to win them over, to win them into love, to convert them, to convert our enemies with love. So how do I love Donald Trump? I said his name there, I'm getting better. And most importantly, perhaps, is how do I love the millions of people who voted for him, who think it's particularly the ones who voted for him specifically because of the things that I think are dreadful, that they see those as good. Love your enemies and pray for them. The morning of my shower epiphany, I thought, okay, well, that's the call. I'll pray for him. And I tried to get those words out and they choked me. I could not pray for that man. I wanted to pray against him. I wanted to pray about him, but not for him. And I realised that I had spent the whole previous day calmly weighing up the costs and benefits of someone assassinating him. I had calculatedly wished this man a violent death. And I was horrified at the violence in myself. And even then, I probably wasn't horrified enough because there was still part of me going, wouldn't be so bad. And I don't know how prayer works. I don't know what prayer is really. But on this morning, prayer worked for me to draw me to an awareness of my own violence. How can I love the ones who support Trump values? There's no one actively pursuing me or my friends yet. So the Martin Luther King, Walter Wink third way of active non-violent response is not quite where we're at the moment. So here's some thoughts I've had in the last month. Listen. I need to listen. Lots of commentators are saying that the people who overwhelmingly voted for Trump have felt that for decades the political and intellectual establishment has stopped listening to them, which is me. I am the intellectual establishment. I'm not political at this point, but now, I can scoff at this and point to the way that aspirational voters have been running politics and their causes have been lifted up and given excessive weight. But that is me from my intellectual pedestal looking at someone else and saying, that thing you're feeling, actually, that's wrong. You can't feel that. No, I can't say that. I do not have the right to tell someone else what they do or don't feel. I don't have to agree with them to truly listen, to ask what is the heart cry of the people I disagree with. Yes, I want to be listened to too. Who's listening to me? Why should I listen to them and they not listen to me? Perhaps this is the turn the other cheek for me, to give up my right to be listened to in order to really listen. If after that I still have something worth hearing, I may actually have people interested in hearing it by then. But it's not about currying up an audience. It's about listening. How do I love these people? I need to let go of my progressive political agenda. Because praying for my enemies does not mean converting them to my agenda. And listening to them is not an information gathering strategy so I can eventually get them on my team. How much of my shock and hurt comes out of my wounded sense that I'm right and you're wrong, and how could you be so stupid? It's not very loving to write off millions of people as stupid or to assume that I'm better than them, I'm smarter than them, I know what's best for them. Which is what I imply when I say, let me help you to see how I see it. Let me pray that you see things my way. And I need to acknowledge what does make sense. People who do listen are saying, this experience we're having now, many of us, of the ones in power have got no idea. Their ideas are all wrong. they are going to stuff it up for the people I love. This experience we're having now has been the experience for decades of the people who voted for Trump. And then, how does that feel? How does it feel to have that sense of despair for decades? We're experiencing it now. We can feel it. And then someone comes who speaks your language, who says the things you've been grumbling about at the pub for the last 20 years, and seems to think they're going to actually do something. Well, how does that feel? I think perhaps people who voted for Trump have had the feeling, the emotional response that I have when I see the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. Oh, someone who gets it, finally, and he's actually got the guts to do something about it. It's such a rush, isn't it? How many of you, when you saw Justin Trudeau in a pink shirt with a Syrian refugee at the front of the Pride parade, went, yeah, you know, and had that? This is how people have felt when they saw Donald Trump saying the things that meant something to them. I can understand, then, the wave of support. The next thing, how do I love these people? I need to pay attention to what this says about me. For example, at some point, I just don't like losing. When my team wins, I expect the people who are disappointed to kind of get on board with the program. But when my team loses, I'm sour. I am maybe just a sore loser. Particularly a sore loser because I didn't get a vote in this one. It affects me, but I'm not there. I need to pay attention to what this says about my desire to annihilate what makes me uncomfortable or what seems to me to be wrong. And perhaps this is as strong in me as it is in those who seek to do away with minority groups or powerful women or people who don't look like themselves. I need to ask myself, who would I put behind the wall? Perhaps it would be people who voted for One Nation. Perhaps a subset of particularly extreme bogans. Perhaps neighbours who have tantrums if small children breathe on their plants. Given the opportunity, who would you excise? Because it's in all of us the desire to do it. If it's not in you, that's fine. You can meet me in the park afterwards and show me how it's done. Who would you excise? Perhaps it's just a lack of opportunity that means you're not doing it. And I need to pray. Whatever that means, how that works, I need to open myself to God and ask God to remember these people I hate as God's beloved children. And I need to pray for my own transformation because I cannot hope to pour out love if I am not tapped into the source of love. I must pray. And finally, I need to pay attention to what comes next. Because loving my enemies does not mean allowing them to perpetrate evil unchallenged. But it does tell me where I am to stand if a challenge is to be made. It does not mean allowing evil to be perpetrated unchallenged. But it tells me, it tells you, where we are to stand when the challenges come. Luke goes on to give examples of what love your enemy means in his culture, in his time. They do not translate well over 2,000 years. They don't make any sense now. But I think what we can say is that none of these examples are passive. Nobody in what Luke is saying encounters an enemy and goes, oh, never mind then. All of them are active responses, and all of them appear to reclaim the full humanity of both parties. In Matthew, they are probably nuanced more towards active non-violent resistance, unveiling the abuse of an abuser, upholding the victim, giving an opportunity for the abuser to make a different choice. In Luke, they're nuanced slightly differently so that they're more about contrasting an economy of ethical calculations with one of gift and abundance. So there's the existing system of goodies and baddies, and how whether I'm a goodie or a baddie in relation to you depends on the sum of all our interactions, positive and negative. Luke undercuts in this passage both the positive and the negative. Both, if you've had someone treat you badly, your enemy, do not respond in kind. But he also goes on to say, if you're with your friends and you're only loving your friends, well, that's just working the economy of love, the economy of interaction. That's not what we're on about either, he says. We're on about something else. Luke is giving us a worldview of gift and generosity rather than mine and yours, good and bad, rights and responsibilities. And we teach are always, always into systems of reciprocity. What do I owe you and what do you owe me? But Luke here is issuing Jesus' call instead to operate in what Herman Hendricks call the poetics of love. Not the economy of ethics, but the poetics of love. Now, perhaps Trump is not your enemy. For a start, there's plenty of enemies closer to home. Perhaps it's Pauline Hanson and her One Nation voters. Or perhaps it's Richard Di Natale and everyone who votes Green who you just can't stomach. Perhaps it's a Premier pushing ahead with an unpopular highway through a wetland. Perhaps it's a bureaucrat axing radio programs. Perhaps it's someone you will sit down with at Christmas, because families are funny beasts and they throw the oddest people together. Now, because this is not my normal sort of sermon, I'm going to do another not my normal thing. I'm going to pray right now while you can't escape. I'm going to ask you right now to think of someone you hate, someone who could be an enemy, and I'm going to pray. Oh God, we are haters. We are haters. Melt our hating and teach us to love. Hold us close, so close we can hear the heartbeat of your love as we seek to love our enemies. God, we each hold up to you now someone we do not want to love. Creator God, remember the ones we are thinking of now. Remember them as your beloved children, made for your good. Amen. As we wait and hope towards a better world this Advent, let us sink our roots deep into God, who loves your enemies, but also loves you, with a poetry that we don't understand.